Did you know there's a computer malware that can take screenshots of your email, secretly record your conversations, and steal your passwords? This hour, a look at the newly discovered Flame and how this cyber espionage tool hijacks a computer. Plus, why researchers say that they have been wrong all these years about the root of heart disease. A new study shows stem cells may be to blame for clogged arteries. Could this discovery steer treatment in a different direction? Finally, a different kind of flame, the contest. Alan Auld is back to talk about the results of the Flame Challenge, and we'll meet the mind behind the winning entry, which is also our pick of the week. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hi, Ira Flatow here. You won't believe it. Something happened to our website. It got an extreme makeover. Go over to our website, have a look, and let us know what you think. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Meet Flame, every PC owner's worst nightmare. This newly discovered malware gives an attacker remote access to your computer. It can listen in on your conversations, look through your webcam. It was first detected in the Middle East and has been infecting computers for at least 2 years. Antivirus experts are calling Flame one of the most complex threats ever discovered. Once a machine is infected, the operator of the malware can expand its functionality almost like adding apps to a smartphone. Its operator sent out another app with orders to erase it this week, leaving no tracks behind. Much like Stuxnet, Flame is also believed to be the handiwork of a nation state. Why are antivirus experts so concerned about Flame? How does this malware tool spy kit and eavesdrop? Who is behind Flame and who are they targeting? And why is it being compared to Stuxnet? That's what we're going to be talking about this hour. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. My guest is Kim Zetter. She is senior reporter at Wired, covering cybercrime, privacy, security, and civil liberties. She's currently writing a book about Stuxnet and joins us from Oakland, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
What makes Flame different?
Well, different from the average run-of-the-mill malware that criminals use?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question, because when it first was discovered, a lot of people were saying, well, this isn't new, because there is a lot of spyware out there already used by criminals. The difference here is the complexity of the malware in this case. It does some of the same things that other malware does, stealing passwords, taking screenshots, that kind of thing. But the motivation is obviously different, and it comes with just a multitude of functions, much more than something that cyber criminals would use. Cyber criminals, usually their malware is very compact in the sense that it's doing only the precise thing that they want to do, which is often just stealing your banking credentials or credit card numbers.
Right.
So Flame has, so far they found about 20 modules that can be swapped in and out. And they do everything from turning on the internal microphone and webcam on your computer, this way that they could record conversations that you have over Skype or conversations that you have in the room in the vicinity of a computer. It takes screenshots of your communications. They seem particularly interested in any email communications or instant messaging. Communication that you do. And it also turns your computer into a Bluetooth beacon. So if you have Bluetooth enabled on your computer, they will turn that on and do a discovery for other Bluetooth enabled devices in the vicinity, such as a phone. And they will use your computer to then siphon the contact information that is in any phone in the area.
Wow. Why all those things? I mean, what's the reason for that?
Well, it's a toolkit. And so what we think it is it's multifunctional. Depending on what the particular need is for the attackers, they probably use this in multiple operations, a variety of operations. And so depending on what they need for a specific target, what they want to steal, they will only download those particular modules to the system. So in some cases, they may be wanting just documents. And so they'll just, download a module that does that. If they want to be listening to meetings that are happening in a room, want to be monitoring email of who's communicating with who, then they would download, those kinds of modules.
Who's the they behind this?
Well, that's the mystery. If we look at where the infections are occurring, and you mentioned that it's primarily in the Middle East, there have been a scattering of infections in Hungary, Austria, Hong Kong, but they're mostly in Iran, places like Syria, Sudan as well, Lebanon, and some cases in occupied West Bank and inside Israel. But the inside Israel ones may be unique for specific reasons. So if you look at where it's infecting geographically, that can tell you something about who might be interested in those particular areas. And since there seem to be some correlations between FLAME and Stuxnet, and we're pretty sure that Stuxnet, well, actually, I guess the U.S. has copped to Stuxnet, we're pretty sure that FLAME is done by the same people, or at least backed by the same people. It's not programmed by the same programmers, but it's done by people who had the same resources behind Stuxnet. And, of course, Stuxnet was Israel and the U.S.
So this is the next generation of a Stuxnet in a much more complex version?
No, I actually think that this was a precursor to Stuxnet. So when you do a mission like Stuxnet where you're sabotaging a system, you need to gather information about that system first. And the New York Times had an article last week in which they talked about how Stuxnet was conducted, and they said that a program was planted on the target machines first in order to conduct espionage and siphon out information about the system before they designed an attack for it. So FLAME could be used for something like that, but this, I don't think FLAME was. Yeah. FLAME is pretty bulky, and it's not elegant for that kind of activity. But it would probably be used maybe in conjunction with something like that, a pre-stage of a mission.
Does it attack all operating systems, your iPad, your iPhone, your Mac, your PC, all those?
It's focusing on Windows systems, so it's we're talking about computers here, and it's very it's doing a lot of steps before it actually infects a system. It's making sure that it's checking what kind of antivirus you have installed, and so it's going to make decisions based on that to try and thwart the antivirus. It's looking for other capabilities on the system that might help it spread to other systems on the network. So it wants to spread, but in a limited manner, not like Stuxnet spread.
Yeah, usually your malware is, 10 to 15 kilobytes. This is a 20 megabyte piece of software. So it's intelligent on its own. It's making decisions as it goes through there about whom to attack, what to take out, what to do along those lines.
It's not making a lot of decisions on its own. It's making some decisions on its own. When it first gets on a system, there are three versions that have been found so far of different size, and one of them is about 6 megabytes, and that's a pretty bulky one.
Yeah.
And the others are more pared-down versions with fewer modules. So the 6-megabyte one has a lot of modules in it. And what the system does, once it gets on a system, is it installs itself, and then it calls home to a command and control center. And the command and control center then can send down other modules. So it's basically, it can be controlled remotely. So it has some autonomous capability inside, but it's also looking for additional functionality to come from the attackers.
Is there any way to protect your PC from this?
Well, yes, antivirus systems, antivirus engines are now equipped with signatures to detect this and toolkits to eliminate it. So FLAME, for any system that's up to date with antivirus, it's not at risk of this.
Didn't the controllers try to snuff out the FLAME this week, telling the sort of to get rid of its tracks or where it headed out and send out another little app?
Well, it sent out a new version last week to three systems that were in Iran. I think it was Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon. And it basically updated itself with a new version. There is a module that will erase FLAME, but a lot of the systems were already taken offline last week. And FLAME was discovered, or FLAME was exposed a week ago last Monday, and antivirus companies already had signatures out there. So for most infections out there, the systems probably would have already been erased of FLAME. So sending out a module at that point wouldn't have helped much.
If it's already in your computer, how do we know it's just not sitting there waiting to do something else?
Well, it could be. I mean, if you don't have detection for your system, it could indeed still be sitting there. And there are actually so the antivirus companies, Kaspersky in particular in Russia, set up a sinkhole to actually intercept the traffic that would have gone to the attacker's command and control centers. And so they are still seeing activity from infected machines. So there are machines out there that either don't have antivirus installed on them at all or don't have updated versions, and so they still are infected, and they're communicating now with Kaspersky's sinkhole.
And we don't know what the reason. I mean, you say that it's got all kinds of purposes that it could do, but we don't know exactly. For example, with Stuxnet, it attacked the centrifuges. It had a specific specific job to do. We don't know what that job in this case is.
No, but we believe that it's probably multiple jobs, depending on who the target is. I mean, you've got targets in the occupied West Bank. You've got targets in Syria and Lebanon. They may be targeted for different reasons. So, you know, they could be looking at maybe suspected terrorist cells to see the communications between them. But one of the interesting things about Flame is the documents that they're stealing, one of the primary interests they have are in AutoCAD documents. And AutoCAD is a software that's used to create a computer rendition of things like building plans, factory layouts, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And could there be other sophisticated malware out there that's waiting to be discovered?
No doubt, yes.
Even more powerful than Flame?
Possibly more powerful or an offshoot of these. Yes. Yeah, there's no doubt. This has been Flame has looks like created probably around maybe 2007, 2008. So, you know, we're talking 5 years ago, and Stuxnet was created a little bit after that. And then you've got Dooku that came out a year after Stuxnet. So these are just three of them. And, yeah, there's no doubt that there are others.
Mm-hmm. And once again, you're saying that for people who are concerned, if you update your Windows, Microsoft has a patch out now too, doesn't it? It should remove it from your PC?
Well, Microsoft's patch is different. Microsoft patches the vulnerabilities that the Flame used to spread on a machine or to get on a machine. If you have antivirus updates, that's the thing that will prevent you from getting infected as well.
And is there any possibility that this was done by a bunch of hobbyists or people who want to, you know, just show that they can get into systems?
No, not the amount of work that went into this is not hobbyist. The targets, the geographical region of the infections, and there are some parallels to Stuxnet in this. And on this week, there were a couple of researchers that discovered. Well, Microsoft revealed this week that the attackers had been using a vulnerability in Windows Update to spread.
Uh-huh.
And the way that they took advantage of that vulnerability is quite sophisticated. And in fact, there were a couple of cryptographers who came out with a report saying this week that it was beyond the abilities of an attack that they had developed.
Kim Zetter, thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
You're welcome.
Kim is a senior reporter at Wired, and she's writing a book about Stuxnet. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about why stem cells may be the real culprit behind clogged arteries and atherosclerosis. And might upset and overturn what we think about how hardening of the arteries and the clogging of the arteries happens. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Ira here, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do, our radio show, podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, and more, if you appreciate that and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to contribute whatever you can by pressing on the donate button on your smartphone or iPad app, or going to our website at sciencefriday.com and making a tax-deductible donation. Thank you. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Every once in a while, there's a study that gives scientists a new way to look at an old problem. And a group of researchers say their study in Nature Communications this week does just that. Now, for decades, scientists have thought that heart disease is caused by smooth muscle cells that line the walls of blood vessels. The belief is that when blood vessels are damaged by LDL, or that bad cholesterol, the smooth muscle cells are triggered to proliferate. So they build up scar tissue that makes the vessel both narrow and hardened. And these changes can restrict blood flow and may cause heart attack or stroke, a leading cause of death in America. But a team led by scientists at UC Berkeley says that they have uncovered the real culprit behind clogged arteries, and it's not just smooth muscle cells as previously thought, but stem cells, a finding, if corroborated, that could lead to a new direction for future treatment of heart disease. Dr. Jill Helms is a professor in the Department of Surgery at Stanford School of Medicine. She is co-author of the study and joins us from Stanford. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, my pleasure to be here, Ira. I want to start off by telling you that you and Science Friday have a great fan base here at Stanford.
Well, that's very good to hear. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We're enjoying the work that you're helping us broadcast about, which is what I want to talk today about. This is really interesting. Before the study, we thought that clogged arteries are clogged by how, and what have you done to change that view?
Well, I think that the prevailing idea was that clogged arteries are caused by a group of cells that exist around a blood vessel, and they begin to grow or proliferate, as you had mentioned. And I guess it's sort of like a pair of Spanx that goes out of control. You know, normally the cells around the vessel hold it in a snug manner, but when the cells around the blood vessel grow too much, then they narrow the lumen or the diameter of the vessel. And I think that's where the big, of course, we understood which cells were responsible, or I should say we thought we knew. And that's where Song Lee and his students made a really critical insight. They saw that instead of this just smooth muscle cells, there was actually two populations. And the second was a stem cell-like population. This appears to be the cells that caused the trouble.
So the stem cells start to proliferate and create smooth muscle cells on the wall of the artery?
They create all sorts of things, excuse me, as a consequence of there being stem cells. Of course, they're capable of differentiating into lots of different cell types, and that's what Song showed. He showed that they could differentiate into fat-producing adipocytes, bone-producing osteoblasts, even differentiate into neural cells. And that's where he made a key discovery, I think, in that understanding that these were stem cells.
And so these cells, would they be lining the artery walls in all different forms?
That's right.
As bone, yeah. You know, that's why there's calcium deposits there sometimes, perhaps, because it may be bone?
That's right. That's wow. The capability of these cells to differentiate into bone-producing cells is, of course, associated with vascular diseases. And so I guess where I came in was that we were working on these areas, even though he works just across the bay from me. Mm-hmm. I met him at a meeting in Japan that was sponsored by the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, or CIRM, and they fund a lot of stem cell research in California.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you do to prove this, to show it in operation?
So the important part was to be able to demonstrate that these cells really were stem cells. And he had an idea that they were derived from a population called the neural crest. And that's the area that I work in. Neural crest cells are an embryonic population of cells that have the same ability to make fat, bone, cartilage, nerve. And as a consequence of the similarities between the two cell types, we found that indeed these cells that exist around the vessels, these stem cells that exist around the vessels look like neural crest cells. Mm-hmm. This gives us a real handle on what their behavior is and what might regulate them in disease states.
Well, if you see them there, could you actually show them in action clogging the arteries up?
Well, in action is a difficult thing because that requires some kind of dynamic visualization of the process. And, right. You know, it's a slow process getting our arteries hardened. But what you can do is create the disease in animals and then follow, using genetic strategies, follow the fates of the cells so that we can sort of indelibly label the cells when they're still stem cells and then follow where they go in the disease state. And using that kind of approach, we're able to show that they are indeed stem cells.
So you can label them with a dye or something and see where they proliferate. And if they line the arteries, there they are. And they're creating stuff.
Very close to that. It's a genetic strategy, so it's not a dye, actually, but a gene that it makes a protein that can be detected by a dye reaction.
1-800-989-8255, talking with Dr. Jill Helms, saying that, if I may summarize this, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that that stem cells are at the root of hardening of the arteries. That simple.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. And
I will say that one of the big opportunities this presents is that when you know the cause of a disease, then you can start thinking about ways to target that disease process. And this is where our collaboration is going. And Song has developed a number of techniques mm-hmm. to rapidly screen drugs that will specifically target these cells and not the cells that line a blood vessel called the endothelial cells. So sparing one cell and targeting the other for therapy.
But stem cells are all over the body, are they not? Could you target the wrong kinds of stem cells?
Absolutely. That's certainly a concern. And so it's lucky that they are spatially restricted. So we know exactly where they reside. If one were to think about targeting, you'd have to take into account that sort of spatial component.
1-800-999-8255 is our number. Now, with the discovery that stem cells cause heart disease and hardening of the arteries, would they not be good candidates for other things that go wrong?
Exactly. Right. So instead of now, of course, the therapies for treating hardening of the arteries or narrowing of the blood vessels are mostly procedures that physically widen the inside of the blood vessel or else replace the damaged vessel by grafting.
Like a stent or something like that.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So there may be an opportunity here to think about regenerating the correctly formed kind of stem cells that reside around the blood vessels.
And would they be able to replace the damaged ones if they regenerate?
Well, of course, that's still in the future, but I think that's definitely a feasible option.
Mm-hmm. And as far as things that are not concerned with the heart, other illnesses, could stem cells, let me just throw out a few illnesses, could they be involved in arthritis or something else like that? And
we don't
know that yet, you know?
That's right. We don't know it about arthritis, but I will tell you that the cancers is certainly a disease that looks very much like a stem cell gone out of control. And so if we understand what normally regulates a stem cell's behavior, then we gain some crucial insights into what regulates maybe a cancer cell's behavior. It's that kind of approach that I think that CIRM is largely funding initiatives to try to target human diseases, the big ones,
yeah.
The ones that make us all sort of quake in our shoes, in an attempt to come up with new therapies.
Yeah, a couple of questions come to mind is why, and you'd want to know why only in some people do the stem cells get activated to do these.
That's right.
Right? What's the vulnerability
That's right.
there?
What is, and we know some of the things, right? We know some things that activate stem cells, like repeated injuries, things like smoking, inhalation injury triggers the activation of stem cells around the lumen of the bronchioles, or drinking to excess, you know, damages the liver, activating stem cells there that then go out of control. So clearly, understanding how injuries, some environmental influences, and of course, the genetics of each individual, how those may play into activating these stem cells and leading to disease.
Bridget in Raleigh, North Carolina wants to join us. Welcome, Bridget.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just had a quick question. When you refer to hardening of the arteries, are you referring to arteriosclerosis, atherosclerosis, or both in this context?
I think both is a fair is certainly atherosclerosis.
One is okay. Tell us the difference quickly between them, Dr. Helms.
Well, this is getting outside of my area of expertise because I'm not a cardiologist.
Well, there's a simple. I mean, one. I'll just take a shot at it, just to be.
Okay.
One is thickening of the. One is narrowing of the passageway in the arteries, and the other is actually hardening of the arteries, and those are two different things. Would you go that far with me?
Yes, I'd go that far. Okay. I guess because I'm thinking about the contribution of these cells to disease, I would say it's more closely linked to atherosclerosis.
And that is the narrowing of the arteries?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what do the stem cells normally do when they're there and they're not doing, turning into doing this bad thing? What are they normally doing in the body there?
We have no idea.
We don't.
We have no idea what their normal role is sitting there. And then that begs the question, how did they get there? Where did they come from? Were they always there from the beginning of our embryonic life? Or did they migrate there in response to a stimulus? We don't know.
Wow. But we knew they were there for how long? When did we discover that?
Oh, only recently. Yeah. I think this is probably the biggest discovery that comes out of this work from Song Li and his colleagues and in which I participated.
So wouldn't you think if there are just stem cells in the arteries and we know that they float around in the bloodstream, that there are stem cells everywhere else in other tissue?
Well, bones? Stem cells don't float around much in the bloodstream unless they're blood stem cells, and most of the blood stem cells are actually in the marrow. So they don't float around. Cells really like to attach to things. You know, that's how they grow, and that's how they have to. Stem cells have to be close to something we call the niche, which is a physical location that provides growth signals that keep the stem cells in a quiescent state. So how did they get there? You know, they didn't just crawl through the body. Mm-hmm. Something had to have caused them to be there, maybe from the beginning of our development,
yeah.
Or maybe not.
Now, your work involves laboratory animals.
That's correct.
When will this be moved over to humans, to look at humans in these
cases? I think that's one of the, you know, most basic scientists that work in stem cells and in the area of stem cell are trying as hard as possible to move this into translational therapies, things that can be used in humans. And, of course, CIRM, our funding institution, is very adamant about this being the trajectory. So, you know, I'd be taking a stab at it, but 5 to 7 years? Mm-hmm. I think that the ability to rapidly screen existing drugs for their ability to target the cell population is why we think that it might have a shorter course to getting into humans.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Gina in Barrington, New Jersey. Hi, Gina.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
Yes, I found this very interesting. I actually used to do a little bit of research myself in atherosclerosis and diabetes, and we kind of looked at things from a higher up look, and I wondered what your thoughts were on with the stem cells actually congregating and proliferating there. Why would they actually be going there? And would you believe this to be part of the theory that inflammation in and of itself, that atherosclerosis is an inflammatory disease, and that is really the root cause is actually our lifestyle, eating behaviors, and lack of activity in general that's causing our body to react in an inflammatory manner?
All right, Gina, thanks.
Wow, that's a great question. What causes them to get to the site of injury or where the injury happens, and what activates them if they're already there? And inflammation, as the caller pointed out, is a key feature of a lot of kinds of diseases, including this one. And so it may well play a role. The difficulty is that most mouse models or animal models that try to sort of test the contribution of the immune system, we can only knock out certain parts of the immune system. It's very hard to collectively say it's due to an immune response or an inflammatory response. But it's clearly on the short list of the causes that lead to the activation of these cells.
You know, whenever you come up with a sort of paradigm-shifting idea, like this seems to be, there's great resistance to accepting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think scientists recognize it's sort of the aha, right? If you look hard, sure enough, there they are. So I think it is there is resistance oftentimes, but there can be moments where there's great clarity. And I think Song's work certainly falls within that category.
Will it have to be repeated by others to confirm what?
You know, that is exactly how science is done. Show again. It's called research, not search. So I guess that means that, yes, absolutely. We need to confirm it in other animals, too. And now the group is getting human cells from diseased arteries, coronary arteries, to see if this paradigm still holds true in humans. Of course, that's our target.
Yeah. Is it the same kind of stem cells in humans? as in these lab
animals?
Yes,
they appear to be very, very similar. There's pretty much an indistinguishable. If there are differences, we haven't found them yet.
Let me get.
That makes mice a pretty good model.
Let me get a quick question in from Andrew in Morristown, Tennessee. Hi, Andrew.
How are you all today?
Hi there.
My question is, well, first I have a comment. I've believed for a number of years that stem cells are going to really just be a great thing in the medical, like, community. I think that...
Andrew, if you have a question, you got to get it in soon because we're running out of time.
Okay, sorry. Do you think that this new study will hurt stem cell research?
Okay.
Absolutely not. The more we know about how stem cells behave, the more we can control that behavior, whether it's to repress them or to activate them. So it's all about getting the instruction manual for how a stem cell works. That's our goal. And with that information in hand, we can attack a lot of diseases.
Were these embryonic stem cells or were they other kinds of stem cells?
These were adult stem cells. Mm-hmm. These are all adult stem cells. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Helms, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
And thanks for all you folks listening out there in your school. Dr. Jill Helms is professor in the Department of Surgery at Stanford School of Medicine and co-author of the study in Nature Communications. We're going to take a break, and after we come back from the break, Alan Alda is back with the winner of his flame challenge. We'll have the winner on. We'll be talking with Alan Alda and the winner, and Flora is going to join us because it's also our video pick of the week. If you haven't seen this video yet, it's amazing. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Get yourself a preview of the video before we go to it after the break, and we will talk about the flame challenge with Alan Alda after the break. So stay with us. We'll be right back. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Our multimedia editor, Flora Lichtman, is here to join us now to talk about the Flame Challenge. Welcome, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Remember back in March when we talked to Alan Alda?
Of course, who could forget?
And he told us about the flame contest. He challenged scientists around the world to explain what a flame is in a clear, engaging, and meaningful way so that even an 11-year-old like he was when
or
he
me.
Wondered about
or you know, could understand.
Could talk about it. Well, more than 800
wow.
entries later, the results of the contest are in, and joining us now for an update is Alan Alda. In addition to being an actor, director, and screenwriter, he's also a founding member of the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. Welcome back.
Thank you. Hello, Ira. How are you?
Tell us about what this voyage was like, getting all the way to the final contestant.
You know, it was amazing. I think that we expected maybe at the most a couple of hundred responses. And what happened was you picked up on it, ABC News picked up on it, the New York Times, various news organizations. In fact, I was even interviewed by a radio station in Ireland. And everybody picked up on the idea, which helped get people's interest. So we had a lot of scientists around the world in all different countries entering the contest. And then school teachers signed up their classes in, I don't know how many countries, a lot all over America and many other countries. So it really became a worldwide thing, which surprised us. And then the quality of some of the responses was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And the response of the kids was amazing. We have some videos of kids discussing the entries. And one of the most surprising things to me was while they rated entries highly if they were videos, if they had humor in them, and if they were easy to understand, they rated them highly on those criteria. But they demoted them, they took points off if there wasn't enough information. They kept talking about how they wanted information and how they needed to learn and remember from these entries what a flame was. That was very heartening to me, and I think it should be instructive to scientists too.
Yeah, because the kids didn't want it dumbed down.
No, they really didn't. In fact, one kid said, you know, we're 11, we're not 7.
So the kids were the judges, right? Did they actually do the selecting?
They did. They did. They did everything except check it for accuracy. So we had a number of scientists who were qualified to check the entries for accuracy before they went to the kids, who did the entire judging process. They were in charge of it. They narrowed it down to a group of finalists in the first round, and then it was sent out. The finalists were sent out to them again, and they chose the winner.
And what made the cream of the crop the cream of the crop?
Well, I think it was clarity, engagement, explaining difficult words. As a matter of fact, this entry uses three or four words that are not familiar to most of us who haven't been trained in science, and the kids loved it because they learned what these words meant in an engaging way. So they were not satisfied with some kind of a metaphor that just sort of generally related to what the process was. They wanted something about the process of the flame in specifics, and they got it in the most engaging way in this this winner of the contest.
I think we should bring on the winner, because actually the winner of the contest is this week's video pick of the week. We couldn't pass this one up. The video was just too good. It had a cupcake in it and an original song.
And a guy chained to the wall in hell.
In hell.
Talk about flames.
Who could pass that up? Went right to the source. So we have Ben Ames here with us. He's the one who made this video. He's a PhD candidate in quantum optics at the University of Innsbruck in Austria. Welcome to the program, and congratulations, Ben.
Hey, thank you very much, and I have to say it's great to be on the show. I'm a big fan, have been.
How did you hear about the contest?
Well, you know, we've come full circle. I heard about it on the Science Friday podcast. I was working in my lab. I'm an experimental physicist, so I was fixing some problems with my setup and listening to some old podcasts that were filtering through my computer, and lo and behold, fell upon the contest this way. So,
how much time did you have between then and
I had less than 2 weeks. So I heard about the contest, and I thought, if I'm going to do this, I've got to take work off, and so that's what I did.
So what prompted you to actually take work off and do all this work? I mean, you can tell there's a lot of craft and care put into this.
You know, I think I always have had a genuine desire to understand the natural world around me, and I think a lot of kids generally do. But as a kid, you know, my science educators were great, but for some reason, nothing really resonated with me, and I knew that I wanted to make something that I would have liked to have heard about or watched as an 11-year-old, and so, you know, I'm still quite ignorant in physics, which is what I study. And so I like to communicate to others the way that I like to be communicated to.
And you have a background in arts to some degree, too, right?
Yeah, I do. I spent my high school doing visual arts. That's kind of, if you ask friends of mine from high school, you know, or tell them that I'm a physicist now, they'd all laugh because I was doing theater and art and then music.
Mm-hmm. In fact, your video features a song. And I think we'd like to play a little clip of it.
Okay, great.
The fuel loses mass, it turns to a gas before the next change is through. Some atoms shine blue when the process is complete. It gives off heat, extra carbon will glow, red, orange, yellow.
Where did this song come from? Seems perfect.
You know, I was sitting in an electronics class at the University of Utah during my undergraduate, and I really wasn't focusing too much on the lecture at hand, but I was thinking about how I wanted to get home and play this song, this little riff that was going through my mind, and so I did. I just recorded it with GarageBand and a cheap little $100 guitar that I had, you know, and it just sat on my hard drive for 4 years, and I had no real use for it. until I heard about the contest, and I knew I wanted to have music involved, and so I just had to add some catchy lyrics, and there you have it.
You had it in the can.
Alan, is this how they do it in show business?
You know, I he could rule show business if he decides to get out of quantum physics.
No, thanks.
We were thinking
actually,
the
show
same
business
thing.
Is a lot harder than quantum physics, but you could do it anyway. He's an extraordinary artist in this. He gives a great narration. He plays the part beautifully. He's got a song that he wrote, and he's a great teacher because this song is the summary of the video, but all of these ideas in that song are so fully explained earlier in the video that you get it. It's not these are not foreign terms to you by now. These are things you just want to hear over and over again to the music. And kids love it because they report that it helps them remember the ideas. The song goes through their head all day, whether they want to think about it or not.
It'd be a bad thing, right?
You know, this reminds me of Schoolhouse Rock. It seems in that genre.
Yeah, you know, I didn't watch a whole lot of Schoolhouse Rock as a kid. I remember it coming on in between Saturday morning cartoons. But, you know, I wanted music because my wife, she still sings this song that she learned when she was in seventh grade. She can name every country on the continent of Africa from this song that she learned, and it stuck with her. And I thought, hey, if I can do something like that with Flames, then that'll be a good thing.
Did the idea of using Lego, a boxing ring, come to you right away? I mean,
you know, not Legos. Maybe it did. You know, as a kid, you see all these complicated diagrams of molecules, and I tried to actually not even. Well, actually, I didn't use the word molecule because I wanted to trim the science fat as much as I possibly could. And so, you know, molecules and atoms. That's yeah, they're building blocks. And so I thought, hey, why not just use building blocks? And originally, I had my video was like 12 minutes long. Over 12 minutes long, and every single bit of my explanation included a few more minutes of explanation, including the chemiluminescence part. I didn't have the fighting ring. I had a guy looking down at the table, and the hydrocarbon and the two oxygen molecules were playing a game of leapfrog, and they would expose these free radicals that would emit light. And I looked at it at the end. I thought, okay, this has gone overboard. And so I just covered the whole thing of Fight Cloud and tried to get the basic idea across.
What I can't imagine that you made it an even longer video in the last 2 weeks that you had.
Just be grateful you didn't see that version.
That's the director's cut, right?
No, I don't know.
The thing he's going to do is Physics the Musical.
Well, that's a good point, Alan. Can you do more of these? I mean, Ben, if we ask you to do more, you do some for our website or videos?
Yeah. Well, you know what? This was such a thrill ride for me because it really, in a unique way, combined both of my passions, and I had never before been involved in something where my mind was so fully engaged. It was a complete rush, and I don't know what the future holds for it, but in either case, just for the sheer thrill of it alone, absolutely, I'll be doing some more.
Well, I hope we can see them on ScienceFriday.com. And everyone who's listening should go check this out, too. This really is a great video.
Right. We've only played a little bit of the music, but as Alan said, there's a 6 minutes in front of that music of incredible animation, explanation, description. I'm running
an
issue.
and
you really do learn a lot in a fun way on this video.
Yeah.
And it's a great beginning for this whole Flame Challenge idea. I mean, this has set the bar really high. And next year, we're going to have another question that will be generated by 11-year-olds themselves, and they'll vote on which question they want it to be and, you know, what the final question is going to be. And maybe Ben will win that again.
I was told I couldn't enter.
So you're not coming up with the idea, Alan, next year. This is going to be what the kids want.
Right. I mean, we had a real 11-year-old come up with this question this time. That 11-year-old was me when I was 11. And I want to see what 11-year-olds come up with. I must say, we announced Ben as the winner at an event at the World Science Festival. And that same day, we said, would everybody in the audience take the card we've given you and write what your question might be for the next Flame Challenge? And the first one that came back was, what is time? That's pretty stiff.
Yeah, a little thesis there. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Ira Flatto with Flora Lichtman talking with Ben Ames and Alan Alda about the flame challenge and the results. And Ben, do you think you can set up a studio to do this? You said you did this sort of in your garage or your basement.
Tell them about where you did it.
You know, I live up in the mountains of Austria, and I have this little cellar that's below the ground floor of my home, and so I cut up this old mattress and I built a little sound booth so I could, and I actually went and spent money I didn't have on a microphone, hoping I could return it when I was done with it, which I couldn't. So now I have this mic sitting on my desk that I have to use again. But yeah, I kind of locked myself away in the basement for over a week, just animating and recording and playing music. It was a lot of fun, but I only got a few hours of
sleep. Not even George Lucas did that.
I don't know.
Alan Alda, do you think that scientists are looking for this kind of outlet? I mean, this wasn't for the cash and fame and fortune, probably, that all these people submitted these great videos. I mean, Ben's a great example.
You know, there may be a creative side or an artistic side. I know there's a creative side to artists, there's a creative side to scientists already. But there may be an artistic side, too, waiting to break free. And I think we're finding that at the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook, where we teach improvising. We teach workshops and improvisation to scientists to get them to be more personal when they're giving a personal presentation. And they eat it up. They love it. It's first of all, it's freeing for anybody. But I think very often they don't get a chance to do something like that. Bowing to the understandable rigors of their profession.
Ben, do you think that because you study quantum physics, which is such a hard thing to explain to lay people, that you've had practice in explanation and may have hit upon something you're good at in explaining these things?
I don't know if I've had a lot of practice at explaining this to a general audience. I mentioned earlier in earlier interviews that I try to explain this to my family, and the first questions I get back are with regards to lightsabers and the possibility of achieving things on the Star Wars and stuff. So I don't know if I'm doing a great job at it, but this was definitely a great lesson in how to do it. I really try to think about what as a kid, what are the essential things I would need to know and what would get me excited. The cool thing about physics is you can kind of take it down to a simplified level. You know, you just on a fundamental level, you're talking about little billiard balls, you know, that are just have a lot of energy bouncing off each other. And so I think it's definitely something I like to continue doing for sure.
Did you have any, were you tempted at all to get into quantum effects in your description?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, so I talk about during these reactions, you get this single atom that spits out light.
Yeah.
So, you know, that alone is a quantum effect. But I definitely didn't want to talk about anything deeper than that.
Well, Ben, congratulations to you, and we're waiting for your next one. We will feature it up on our website. This video is up on our website at sciencefriday.com. You're welcome to become our video producer extraordinaire
in the field
and good luck to you.
Hey,
congratulations.
Ben. Alan Alda, actor, director, screenwriter, and founding member of the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook. We'll wait to see what happens next, Alan.
I'm looking forward to it. It's exciting.
Thanks for being with us today.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to leave you with music from Ben Ames' winning entry. And with me is Flora Lichtman. Thank you, Flora. That was a great video. It's our video pick of the week.
Can't miss this one.
You can't miss it. It's up there on our website. They're about three or so minutes long. This is a
double feature. It's really long. But you'll watch it all the way through. It takes place in hell. What more could you want?
It's a guy chained to a wall in hell learning about flames, right? It all fits together. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Amisha Serena-Anand is our producer. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Sam Flatto, our production assistant. Neil Rauch, our technical director at the controls here in New York. Our iPhone app is produced by Pastime Software. Wayne Hoxie does our Android app. Thanks for listening. I'm Ira Flatow.